Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, and they're all brought to you today by ZipRecruiter. Right now, listeners to Three Martini Lunch can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/free trial. More on them a little bit later in the podcast. Jim, let's start with our good martini. And the good martini really is one that we could have mentioned pretty much every day since November 9th, and that's that Hillary Clinton is not, I repeat, not president of the United States. She has given us ample ammunition since then to back up that belief. There's certainly no shortage of criticisms that we've offered on President Trump since then, but Hillary Clinton's refusal to accept the reality that she lost fair and square is bordering on delusional now, Jim, and her latest effort to do so happened at a tech summit, which is kind of ironic given the issue that dogged her throughout the presidential campaign. But Hillary Clinton, the last time she was talking with Christiane Amanpour, mainly blamed the Russians and Jim Comey. Now she's actually expanded things a little bit. First of all, she talked about how the email scandal really was no big deal, even though she'd never, ever do it again.
This was the biggest nothing burger ever. It was a mistake. I've said it was a mistake. And obviously, if I got to turn the clock back, I wouldn't have done it in the first place. But the way that it was used was very damaging.
I'd love for someone to ask her at some point why she thinks it was a mistake. Jumping off on that, she blames the media for making it a bigger deal than it should have been, especially those rabid conservatives at the New York Times.
I know you had Dean Baquet here from the New York Times yesterday, and they covered it like it was Pearl Harbor. And then in their endorsement of me, they said, this email thing, it's like a help desk issue. So it was always a hard issue to put to bed, but we put it to bed in July, and then it rose up again.
And then if she could only have channeled Jan Brady's voice, Jim, collusion, collusion, collusion.
How did they know what messages to deliver? Who told them? Who told them?
Yeah.
Who were they coordinating with or colluding with? There's all these stories about, you know, guys over in Macedonia who are running these fake news sites. The Russians, in my opinion, and based on the intel and counterintel people I've talked to, could not have known how best to weaponize that information unless they had been guided.
And now Hillary Clinton in a nutshell.
Look, I take responsibility for every decision I made, but that's not why I lost.
Jim, some people deal better with reality than others. She's not one of them.
This was a tour de force of excuse making. You didn't even mention the best part, Greg. I really felt very bad. I don't know if you, this is kind of late breaking news, but Debbie Wasserman Schultz and everyone at the Democratic National Committee really badly burned yesterday by a blame thrower.
Oh, yes.
Third degree burns, and definitely need treatment for that. The fascinating aspect of it is, you know, you're right, she blames just about everybody except herself, almost literally saying it's not my decision making that that did that. You know, again, apparently all of her maps don't have the state of Wisconsin on them. But she says, you know, she goes off. And so there's this gentleman by the name of Andrew Thoreau, who was the director of data service for the DNC last cycle. And he gets onto Twitter and he starts swearing up a storm. The accusations are bad wording, bad word. And I hope you understand the good that the DNC data folks did. And he says, I'm not willing to let my people get thrown under the bus without a fight. The two most interesting tweets that he deleted quickly after putting them up there, he says, all that said, the irony of her bashing DNC data, our models never had Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania looking even close to safe. Her team thought they knew better.
Nice.
I mean, this is, you know, this is the Sharks and the Jets, you know, breaking, you know, on the Democratic side. They're ready to rumble and throw down. This is the airing of the grievances. And it sounds like this guy, the DNC, if he's telling the truth, he's got a really fair gripe. The other fascinating thing is when she says the DNC was underfunded, as I mentioned in the Morning Joe today, look, you add up what Hillary and her super PACs had and spent and what Trump and his super PACs had. She had a $400 million advantage. No candidate running for president has ever had a funding advantage like that. So the idea that she lost because the DNC was underfunded was just ridiculous. Then I went back and I looked up the numbers. She had more than twice as many field offices. She had about three times as many paid staffers in the state of Ohio. We were just there, Greg, right? You, me, and everybody listen. We just watched this election. We were hearing throughout 2016 how much better the Democrat ground game was, how much better their data was, how much better their get-out-the-vote operations were going to be, and that the Republicans, you know, Trump had done almost nothing in this. He was putting it all in the hands of the RNC, and Reince Priebus was doing the best he had with what he had. And, you know, the Democrats would say, we have built the state-of-the-art Ferrari Testarossa of get-out-the-vote systems. And the Republicans were like, yeah, we think this Ford Pinto is going to hold together. It's got a lot of duct tape, but this thing's going to do okay. And lo and behold, it did. Now, why did that happen? At some point, you got to point to the candidates. But, you know, she doing that would mean she'd have to give up on this. I think the more she talks about this, Greg, and the more she talks about how it's not her fault, I can't help but have this this sneaking suspicion that she does have an interest in running again in 2020. My understanding, the best way to summarize everything, Greg, is to say that after acquitting herself, she has announced that she will never stop searching for the real loser of the 2016 election.
Now, she apparently said yesterday that she was not going to run in 2020. You don't think she would lie to us, do you?
Well, her point is, how did those foreigners know to coordinate this message? Well, you know, yeah, they clearly had to be colluding to paint Hillary as untrustworthy, right? That's the only way you could come up with a message like that. So,
what story that came out, regardless of how the information was acquired, wasn't true?
I'm sure we could go back and find something. But, you know, look, there are lots of little stories that, you know, I mean, she denies saying we're going to get the filmmaker to the family of those slain in Benghazi. Mm. I guess you could say that's disputed, but, you know, let's say none of us who know that find that the least a bit implausible or inconsistent with the statements she made back then and the overall messaging of the administration. So,
right.
And then to a lot of people, that was the thing that stuck in their craw. You know, you just don't lie at people's funerals. That's
generally
that's kind
good.
Of a basic threshold there that that she flunked.
It's a good policy in life, I think. But in terms of the DNC,
don't lie in general, but really don't lie at the funeral. Right?
Yeah, but the DNC emails, the Podesta emails, nothing in there has been refuted. Just how they were acquired seems to be the biggest thing. So Hillary Clinton still in denial. There's a lot of stages to go after denial. So Jim, this is going to take a while, I think. But Democrats might have good news later on in our three martini lunch today, but we got to wait for that. For now, we go to the bad martini. And Jim, we still think that later today we're going to get good news on the president's announcement regarding the Paris Climate Accords. He campaigned that he would withdraw the United States. We heard from anonymous sources, and we know what those are good for, just yesterday that the United States was going to withdraw. And from what we're hearing today, at least I'm hearing that a lot of the right people that we would like to be invited to this ceremony is a good indication that he's probably going to do that. But in addition to the fact that somebody at the White House clearly jumped the gun on Wednesday, and then other people had to come in and say, well, no, actually, no decision has been made. And even Trump tweeted, we're going to have a decision in the next few days after the anonymous source came out. There's apparently been a flurry of lobbying from within the administration and inside the president's family, among his counselors, because there's a lot of internal division over this. You've got folks like Scott Pruitt at the EPA and Steve Bannon who say, absolutely, we need to withdraw. Then you've got folks like Ivanka and Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, who say it's better if we stay. So I don't know if we're going to get some sort of nuanced decision today, Jim. But the bigger issue here with the bad martini is we've got this just seeming chaos going on behind the scenes leading up to a decision that shouldn't be waiting till the 11th hour.
Yeah. Greg, I'm going to make one point before I start whacking the administration around. I'll say, look, you could say there's a difficult decision here. You could say that, look, if every other country signed on to the treaty knowing there was no enforcement mechanism and basically, you know, decided to sign it with great fanfare and then kind of forget to enforce it and just break their promises, then maybe that might be the easiest course of action for us. That if they're really, if we don't actually have to do it, then you could probably say from the White House perspective, maybe it's easier to not formally withdraw and just ignore it like everybody else is. And then, you know, you still don't have the job losses, you don't have the economic impact, but nobody gives you grief for formally withdrawing. On the other hand, Trump campaigned against this. He's tweeted in the past, he thinks global warming is a hoax. So the idea of staying in Paris Accords, it would be kind of surprising for this. And so you're right. We had this strange confusion yesterday. And a couple people had speculated that, oh, this is his staffers attempting to kind of box him in. Trump hasn't actually reached the decision, but they leaked that he has made the decision one way, feeling like that will create pressure on him. If you're doing that, you're probably like you're a bad staffer. You really shouldn't do that. You really should not go out and put out false information that President Trump has decided on X if he has not actually decided on X, because, you know, the president should make the decision. Now, the second thing, this is a really weird little detail in the Politico story today, Greg. Steve Bannon and Scott Pruitt have sought to outsmart the administration's pro-Paris group of advisors, including Trump's daughter Ivanka, who are hoping the president could be swayed by a global swell of support for the deal from major corporations, U.S. allies, Al Gore, and even the Pope. Now, Greg, I thought we, I thought Republicans voted for the guy so we would have a president who wouldn't be listening to Al Gore on climate change. Right. I mean, I suppose it's polite to take his phone call or something like that. But, Dennis Prager had this column earlier in this week saying, why are never Trump people still complaining about Trump? And why aren't conservatives? This is the time for all conservatives to get on board. Well, look, if we've got a president whose daughter thinks that Al Gore is going to be able to persuade him on climate change treaties, you can't blame us for not trusting this guy. Right? It sounds like he's going to go ahead and withdraw from the treaty. And I think a lot of conservatives will applaud that. But this, there is this nagging sense that Trump is most swayed by the last person who talks to him. And I'm kind of struck by the fact, like, Trump has to know what he thinks about climate change at this point, right? He's got to believe, he's got to know. There's this nagging feeling that, well, if Tillerson tells him one thing and Pruitt or Bannon tell him another, and they're diametrically opposed, we out here in the hinterlands, we the American people, don't really know which decision he's going to make. And that's not really a reassuring state of things for conservatives. That deep down, there's a possibility, we're taping this a little bit before noon on Thursday, that the ceremony's at 3. As far as we know, he's going to withdraw, but we're not 100% sure. And that's just, the markets hate uncertainty. I think Americans hate uncertainty. If you campaigned on doing X, then you really shouldn't do Y unless you've got a really good reason. And so it looks like we're going to dodge a bullet on this one. But I'm just, again, there's this nagging feeling of how this White House makes its decisions. And the sense that one of these days, Ivanka and Jared or Gary Cohn or one of these other guys is going to win over Trump's ear. And we're going to end up with a much more leftward policy than we expected. Because he listened to them and not because of the more right-of-center advisors.
As we speak, Jim, CNN has on their chyron, Trump may add language to satisfy critics over Paris deal. He's still expected to withdraw. But you know when it says Trump may or Trump considering, it's a done deal. There's no way he won't do it now.
Yeah. Weren't we supposed to withdraw from NAFTA by now?
You know what we've learned today, Jim? There's a lot of people in this town who need ZipRecruiter because Trump has some advisors around him that are perhaps steering him away from the instincts that helped him win the presidency. And over on the Democratic side, either everyone but Hillary Clinton needs to be fired or the DNC needs to use ZipRecruiter to find a better candidate. So the question is now, are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then, ZipRecruiter's powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else.
That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, more than 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. You can simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard.
So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes. This isn't just for the big corporations. We're talking big, medium, and even the small mom-and-pop shop. Use ZipRecruiter to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, listeners to 3 Martini Lunch can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. All right, Jim, we've talked about how the Democrats have clearly not gotten over 2016, and so naturally we're going to talk about 2020 now. We already have a number of names out there potentially on the Democratic side. You've got Terry McAuliffe, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker seems to be positioning himself for a possible run. And now a familiar name is being rumored again. This time, Joe Biden. This is from Hot Air, Ed Morrissey, with a little help from the Washington Post. Joe Biden may not run for public office again, but if not, the former vice president certainly knows how to give a great impression of a candidate. The Washington Post reports that Biden will launch a new political action committee looking for candidates in next year's races to compete against the GOP's dominating position on the national stage. The PAC won't be organized for a Biden candidacy yet. Anyway, to the Washington Post, declaring it's time for big dreams, former Vice President Joe Biden is prepared to launch a new political action committee on Thursday, a move certain to stoke more speculation about whether he plans to mount a 2020 challenge to President Trump. The new PAC, dubbed American Possibilities, is being set up to help elect candidates who, like Biden, still believe in a nation of ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Nice, good, encouraging boilerplate language there. So, Jim, Joe Biden, I believe, would be 78, roughly, on Election Day 2020. Trump, of course, would be roughly 74. So it's not exactly a young man's game if that's the matchup. Do you believe him that it's not about his own campaign, or do you think he's still itching to jump in this thing?
Well, for starters, he's got to know how this looks and how this is going to set off a round of speculation about whether he wants to put his hat in the ring again. Greg, I just want you to picture a Democratic debate stage in the fall of 2019 featuring former Vice President Joe Biden, former nominee Hillary Clinton giving it one more shot, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Is this a Democratic campaign field or a sequel to Cocoon? And then like Cory Booker, right, as the kid's sidekick or something like that. It really is very strange. And if you're, the Democrats don't have to take our advice. They certainly, can point out that we look at the world very differently than them. But, man, I'd like to see some fresh blood. I really can't. You got to wonder how strong the party is. If it's, most of its, not only is most of the leadership quite long in the tooth, shall we say, once we throw Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in there. Maybe it is time to turn the page. They always thought of themselves as the party of new ideas and fresh faces and looking at tomorrow and don't stop thinking about tomorrow. And JFK, Bill Clinton, there was always this vibe. No, we're the young party, right? We're the hip, cool party. We're the utterly insufferable party. But and Democrats were the grumpy. The Republicans were the grumpy old men. Well, here we are, and it's been really tough for any rising star to get that much attention or to kind of develop their own persona and following in the party. It's one of the great ironies that two of the exceptions are among the fairly long in the tooth in Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Obama certainly dominated the stage during his presidency. Hillary obviously has been a major factor in Democratic politics going back to 1992, and there just isn't that much media oxygen for somebody to come along and kind of burst. By the way, notice, Greg, we're not hearing any discussion of, hey, why doesn't Tim Kaine run in 2020? Right? I mean, a good portion of the listeners just totally forgot. Oh, that's right. Tim Kaine was on the ticket. I was thinking of the other Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio. Everyone expected he was going to be Hillary's running mate. He was going to be the Latino Obama. He went into the Department of Housing and Urban Development. As far as anyone can tell, disappeared from the earth. As I observe that it's now June 1st and we've not heard about any significant Ben Carson scandals, the Department of Housing and Urban Development is the cabinet equivalent of the Witness Protection Program. You go into it and no one ever sees you again. So that's where the Democrats are right now. So it's not surprising, but attention returned to Biden. He's at least somewhat charming and I think widely liked in the party. You could kind of see him really giving it to Trump in a very interesting way. But, I think if I were the Democrats, I would want somebody new and different to kind of come along and turn people's heads and get a real sense of this is a party that's not willing to put aside the old debates and offer some sort of new solution to the country's problems. But they never listened to me before, Greg, so I don't understand why they would start now.
Well, if Wilford Brimley gets in, we know it's a Cocoon remake. I think he's pretty much
Quaker
the only
Oats.
One. What's that?
Quaker Oats. It's a good thing. Healthy thing to do and a tasty way to do it.
Yeah. He was, I think he's the only one left alive from that movie. And secondly, there were 17 Republicans who wanted to replace Obama. What's the over under on Democrats in 2020 getting in this thing?
I mean, we haven't gotten to the celebrities, right? I mean, if you're, if you are George Clooney or Mark Zuckerberg or The Rock, who I think David French would endorse, even if he was a Democrat, why not? Trump just became president, right? With a celebrity running for president isn't silly anymore. So, I mean, you're going to need, you know, Republicans had to do it in two shifts for their debates. My guess is the Democrats might have three or four. Tune in Saturday, Sunday, and Monday for all three nights of the first Democratic debate.
We all know they're going to clear the field for Kanye. He said a long time ago he's running in 2020.
Yes. So. Make America gold again.
Oh, Jim. Can't wait. Actually, yeah, I can wait. talk to you tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And don't forget to visit our friends at ZipRecruiter. Remember, right now, listeners to 3 Martini Lunch can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. Join us Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.